Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts, beginning December 4th. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
In July of this year, Governor DeSantis put together a team led by State Chief Financial Officer Blaise Ingolia with the stated goal of looking for waste, fraud, and abuse, Florida's version of DOGE.
Our teams are composed of auditors and other skilled staff that are drawn from various state agencies. They will be using the authority that I mentioned to conduct reviews of the data systems, physical premises, and personnel of counties and cities that have thus far refused to cooperate with us to identify and report on any excessive spending patterns.
Within 2 weeks, DOGE landed in Orange County, and their findings are ruffling some feathers. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. It's Thursday, September 25th, 2025. Coming up, hedge funds are gobbling up newspapers in communities across the country, including Orlando. We'll learn about the impacts on communities when their news sources are consolidated and liquidated. And later, WWE superstar Jacob Fatu joins Engage to talk about what makes Central Florida the nexus of the pro wrestling universe. But first, the Florida DOGE team rolled into Orange County in early September, led by state CFO Blaise Ingolia.
I cut my teeth years ago calling out local wasteful spending. What I've seen that local governments are usually have the most egregious patterns of spending money on stuff that, quite frankly, if the voters knew and we shone a light on it, they would probably disagree with.
The team requested more than 186,000 documents pertaining to county appropriations, spending, and programs, encouraging anything the DeSantis administration interprets as relating to diversity, equity, and or inclusion. Last week, Ingolia accused the county of overcharging homeowners by nearly $190 million in property taxes. Orange County Mayor Jerry Demings responded by saying homeowners weren't being overtaxed, that the rate has just adjusted with the explosive population growth, more than 125,000 people moving to the region in the last 5 years. At a September 15th news conference, Mayor Demings explained why the region's tourism industry places stress on county spending.
In 2024, our visitation of 75.3 million tourists with an economic impact of $94.5 billion, according to Visit Orlando. This means that in addition to our permanent resident population, we must provide services for an additional 206,000 people each day.
Mayor Demings joins Engage now. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Mayor. When Governor DeSantis first announced the formation of the state's DOGE, did you presume Orange County would be on the audit list?
I did.
Why?
Well, as par for the course, and, you know, obviously we have a state right now that has a Republican governor that is dominated by a Republican legislature. And it just seems that as par for the course, those counties that tend to be predominantly blue counties seem to get more of the attention than some of the other counties. And secondarily, I would assume that Orange County is a major economic engine for the state of Florida. And because of that, it will have a lot of interest in this county as well.
What kind of information was shared with you prior to the arrival of DOGE in Orange County earlier in September?
Well, there was no direct information specifically shared with me. However, some of our Office of Management and Budget and the County Administrative received some correspondence from the state's Department of Government Efficiency that they will be reaching out and intending to do an audit on date certain. And they requested in advance certain information that they lumped into different categories in preparation for that visit. And our staff provided a lot of that information to them. Hundreds of thousands of documents and data points were provided in advance. When they arrived, we made available our Office of Management and Budget staff, as well as some key other people who they asked to speak with. And we did that right up front to make our staff available for any questions that they may have. They had a certain agenda, I think, that was provided to them in advance. We made our staff readily available. Our staff talked with them openly. These are the staff that's entrusted with managing the respective budgets and providing the oversight that provides the responsive documents for the Board of County Commissioners, as well as others. And most of this information, by the way, is readily available through the Orange County Comptroller's site.
You mentioned that it seemed as though the DOGE team had come into Orange County with an agenda. How would you characterize that agenda?
Clearly, they had an agenda that was to support their desire to force local governments into reducing their budgets for whatever reason. They would have to explain that to you. But clearly, that was their agenda. And secondly, to identify perhaps what they would describe as government waste. But in order to do an effective, objective analysis or audit, you really ought to have some conversation with whoever the leadership team is. Typically, that's the CEO of the organization and other key players. In this case, I am the CEO of Orange County. There's never been any direct conversation with me about the purpose of the audit, what they were looking for, not an introductory meeting or an exit meeting. And to my amazement, they came in before they ever did the audit and they held a press conference and they made certain statements about what was motivating them to come in and to review. And then to my amazement, they came in after they got preliminary information, held another press conference and made accusations without proving anything, not offering any specifics. And they made a lot of assumptions, but I think without a conversation with appropriate persons here internal to Orange County, they couldn't put in context what they were saying, which said to me, they really didn't have an interest in doing an objective audit. They came to some conclusions and accused our staff of being directed to lie or provide misinformation or alter documents.
Let's talk about some of the allegations that were presented by CFO Ingolia. He hasn't released a formal report or provided any data based on what the state DOGE found in Orange County so far. However, he is alleging that the county has overcharged homeowners $190 million overcharge in property tax. He is alleging that Orange County employees are being overpaid, that four employees saw a 25% salary increase over 1 year. And additionally, he is alleging the county is hiding DEI programs that are still in operation. You contend that the growth in the region is leading to some of the growth in those numbers, that 125,000 people have moved to Central Florida over the course of the last 5 years.
Well, let's start with the last point. If you go to the CFO's website and the state of Florida's website, you can cursor down and you can look at what the state says is the population for each of the counties. They work with the University of Florida. The Beber Report is what is called for short, the BEBR Report. Now, if you look at that report says during the time period that was indicated within the audit that our population grew by 125,000. What the CFO indicated in his release of information, that number was 79,047, I believe it is. But it was lower than what the state itself says our population was during the same time period. So I believe he underestimated what the Orange County population was based upon their own records. Number two, it did not take into consideration all of the visitors that we have coming here. The Visit Orlando commissions an organization to estimate the number of tourist visitations here within Orange County. And they estimate that during the 2024 year, we had 75.3 million visitors. So if you take 75.3 and you do simple math, you divide about 365 days out of the year, you will get a number somewhere around 206,000. What that says is that that's every day 206,000 visitors are here that we have to account for and provide services for. They visit our hospitals. They visit our hotels. They drive on our roadways. They call first responders due to traffic crashes and other things that we have to provide services for. And to put all of this into some kind of perspective and context, none of that was taken into consideration.
CFO Engolia is alleging that that information has been hidden or doctored.
Yeah, he made that allegation before he ever even talked to the employees. And by the way, those 16 employees, they decided that they weren't going to interview those employees. None of our employees have been deposed at this point. They were scheduled. They decided, well, before we depose those 16, let us review what you have submitted, and then we'll decide of the 16 who we need to talk to or if it's some other employees. So that has been an exercise and almost in futility at this point. None of our employees have been interviewed. Again, if they really were after the truth, all it had to do was ask us in advance and, after reviewing, doing their due diligence to review the documents, and then the staff would have responded. I want our public to know that I nor any of our senior staff have said that they directed our staff to change documents or any of that. And they produced no evidence that that happened.
What do you think the goal is here? What do you see the end game being for Florida DOGE?
Well, this has been put in place because the governor desires to reduce taxation in Florida. So they started with that in the beginning, which kind of jays this whole process into accommodating or accomplishing what they want to do, and that's to reduce property taxation in Florida. The CFO has been clear that that's what his goal is. Of course, he plans to run for the CFO position. Remember, he was appointed. He had not been elected by the people for this position, but during his tenure as a legislator, he fancied himself as this person who was going to run on local government taxation reform. And that's kind of what his record is.
What happens next?
Well, I would presume that, since they came in here with all of these accusations and they, quote, are doing a DOGE audit, the next step would be for them to produce a report that we already know is going to be dated. And from there, they'll make accusations or what have you. So what I would say to you, the bottom line is this. Orange County has not spent one dime more than what the law allowed us to collect and to spend. Our budget has to balance. We are not like the federal government that can run a deficit.
Sir, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
So what happens next? Can the state alter the county's budget and property tax formula? With what authority does Blaze Engolia and his state DOGE team have to force the hand of county and municipal governments? Joining me to answer those questions and more is Chris Carmody, an attorney with the Orlando office of the lobbying firm Gray Robinson. With what authority is CFO Engolia and the Florida DOGE team undertaking this task? What keeps Orange County or any county really from just telling them to take a hike when they show up asking for documentation?
When the governor signed the executive order back in February for Florida DOGE, there wasn't a lot of legal authority in there. There was an office set up, housed within the Office of Policy and Budget in Tallahassee, and folks started to get appointed, meaning staffers. There was initial inquiries that were sent out earlier in the year to local governments, and some kind of voluntarily said, we're all in, and others just sent the cursory response of, thanks for asking, we're good here. And they didn't have a lot of legal authority. Now, political authority, right? You've got a popular governor. Do you as a local government want to say that you're not for efficiency, right? constitutionally, as you probably know, the state of Florida is required to do it about every 4 years through the Department of Management Services, right? Look for government efficiencies. They just wrapped up that task force in February. Now, that's politically. And some, I would say a decent number of governments, counties and cities volunteered to join in the DOGE movement by mid-June. Now, there's the legal authority as well. When the legislature passed the budget, the one thing they're constitutionally required to do each year, it took them 105 days this year. So we were well into June when that process was taking place with the budget. The budget was this year, Senate Bill 2500 is also the implementing bill. And the implementing bill is to implement the budget, as it sounds like, but it's the laws in there are good for 1 year and they expire come June 30th, 2026. One of the sections was added at the very last day of budget negotiations when they do the budget conference. What that did is it put into effect for 1 year some teeth in the DOGE authority, if you will. And some of that teeth include putting fines in place if local governments did not comply with the request for documents, up to $1,000 a day. And then it also put in there a requirement for a report. But that's where that authority comes from, right? There's the executive authority the governor has to put staffers and people around this housed in the Office of Policy and Budget. But then there was the implementing bill that put an actual law language that says, yes, when CFO Ngolia comes to town and he says he wants X, Y, and Z record, you have to turn it over.
Now, we know that the state DOGE team is philosophically being modeled, at least, on the federal DOGE team that President Trump put together with Elon Musk in leadership, that philosophy being we are seeking out waste, fraud, and abuse in government spending. So my question to you is, through that prism, what does that look like? How do they know when they've identified that?
Good question. So there's a couple things in the actual like executive order and in that law I mentioned. One thing that they've identified as waste, fraud, and abuse, and not sure which category it definitely fits under, but it's number one in the executive order and in the state law that was passed, dealing with any use of resources to support diversity, equity, and inclusion, also known as DEI, those initiatives. Those are sight unseen for this DOGE task force considered to be the waste, fraud, and abuse category, right, of going into it's your government dollars at waste. Beyond that, they use language like potential gross overspending and then waste, fraud, and abuse. As you probably know, CFO Ngolia has not yet released the report about Orange County, where he had a press conference to document or discuss the $190 million that he suggested was waste. He did give some nuggets, though, right, in his press conference, talking about salary increases and duplication of services and such. So we're starting to get a picture. Without that full report released, it's hard to tell exactly what they're identifying, but duplication of services, right, salary increases that don't necessarily line up with the median income in your particular area. Those are easy targets for them, right? It'll be interesting to see the report of what they categorize as waste, fraud, and abuse.
It is a relatively subjective metric.
I would say it's absolutely subjective. Now, I will say this, just this is more based on experience. Knowing CFO Ngolia, myself and others on my team, we've worked with him for many years in the process, both the House and Senate. He is very sharp and understands the optics of these situations very well. So my guess is while some of it that he's going to push the narrative as waste, fraud, and abuse might be objectionable, right, to reasonable people, they could disagree with him. He also is smart enough to know that if it's all objectionable, it won't pass the smell test, right? I would be shocked if he's trying to float a lot of waste, fraud, and abuse that doesn't at least somewhat pass the smell test, if that makes sense, because he's smart enough to know that that would undermine all of his efforts, for lack of better terms.
So what is the end game here? The Orange County budget gets rewritten in Tallahassee. Can the state make recommendations, or could there be an enforcement angle facilitated by the legislature next year?
I think a lot of that is going on in the conversations you're seeing in Tallahassee now. The House has a select committee dealing with a discussion of property taxes. And the CFO in his press conferences hasn't been shy about that, saying that from his perspective, the waste, fraud, and abuse is tied to a need for a reduction in property taxes. So I think no one would suggest that the Doge activities are not at least somewhat related to the concept that there should be a reduction in property tax by some in Tallahassee legislators, executive office, CFO, others. You've heard the governor speak a lot about that in his press conferences, and he's seemingly been discussing it more. The CFO, since he was appointed, that's been very much a focus of his. I don't know if there'll be a prescription to Orange or any other county or any city, but it's largely expected that the House and likely the Senate will put forward some sort of proposal or proposals for the Constitution, a ballot initiative in November, that would discuss some level of property tax reduction.
Chris Carmody is an attorney with Gray Robinson in Orlando. We did request to speak about Florida DOGE with CFO Blaise Ingolia or anybody from his office on three different occasions. We have received no response. Coming up, for more than a decade, newspapers have been bought up by hedge funds that turn around and liquidate the assets for profit. We'll learn about the impact this has on communities across America. And later, WWE legend Jacob Fatu talks about life in the ring and in Central Florida. As always, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at engage@cfpublic.org, or you can send us a talkback on the free Central Florida Public Media app. In the menu, select Send Us a Talkback, record your question or feedback, and hit Send. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Later in the show, we'll learn how the 2013 opening of the WWE Performance Center in Orlando made this region the center of the pro wrestling universe and why so many wrestlers call Central Florida home.
I moved me, my family, and out here. And shout out to Orlando, because, man, let me tell you something. It hasn't been nothing but a hell of a ride since I've been out here. And I'm talking about from the food to the weather, baby, to it not being cold on Christmas out here.
WWE superstar Jacob Fatu joins Engage to talk wrestling, Orlando, and the role his Samoan heritage played in cultivating his in-ring persona. But first, stripped for parts, American Journalism on the Brink is a new documentary that looks at Alden Global Capital, a New York-based hedge fund established in 2007, and its very successful business model of buying newspapers to later liquidate them for their assets, primarily their real estate holdings. The liquidations begin with staff downsizing, then essential resources are sold off. Computers, phone systems, industry subscriptions used by reporters and editors. When the papers are reduced to the bare bones, advertisers flee, the paper folds, and the land is auctioned off. Alden and its shareholders profit. The newspaper staff is left unemployed, and the community uninformed. Rick Goldsmith is the director of Stripped for Parts. The documentary was shown this past Sunday at the Enzian Theater in Winter Park, followed by a discussion focused on how the liquidation of these newspapers is impacting communities across America, including ours. The Orlando Sentinel's parent company, Tribune Publishing, was acquired by Alden Global Capital in 2021. That discussion was led by Goldsmith and Judith Smelzer, the president and general manager of Central Florida Public Media. I sat down with Goldsmith and Smelzer earlier this week to talk about how the consolidation and liquidation of local newspapers and TV stations is impacting communities.
We live in an era of ghost newspapers and news deserts. Ghost newspapers being shadows of their former selves, and now they've been whittled down from maybe 24 pages or 48 pages to 8 or 6 or 4. And news deserts, counties that have no newspapers at all or no news organizations at all. And studies have indeed been done. What these studies have shown is that when local communities lose their main source of news, and it's usually the local newspaper, voting goes down, corruption goes up, expenses for the cities or towns actually go up because there are less guide rails against corruption. Things tend to fall apart more, and insurance companies charge cities more when they know there's no watchdog newspapers around to hold city government to account, local officials of any kind to account.
Can you give an example of a market that has seen that kind of effect?
I know that especially in rural areas and the South, those are the ones that have become news deserts more often. Cities and communities that have a certain amount of wealth and industry around them tend to be able to, you know, weather the firestorms of the loss of local news, and startups happen in those cities. So you're seeing the collapse of local news in the poorer communities first, and more we're seeing the loss of those newspapers in even the wealthier communities. And we're at a crossroads, really. And we've got to figure out what to do with it, because without local news organizations and vibrant ones, democracy can't really work.
Yeah, I think even when it comes to elections, I think another interesting thing that the research has shown is that not only is voter turnout lower when a community doesn't have strong local news, but specifically down ballot voting, voting in local elections and state elections, that specifically is lower. Fewer candidates run for local office when there's not strong local news. And then also split ticket voting is less likely when local news is weaker. And the reason for that is because the more people know about the local issues facing their local communities, the less likely they are to vote based on the D or the R, the more likely they are to vote on what's actually in the best interest of my community. And that's often less partisan than the national election. So I think all of those things are interesting. And then to your question about the connectivity in the civil discourse and civil society, we also see research showing that when local news is strong, people are more likely to join civic groups like the PTA and the Rotary and the Lions Club and the Neighborhood Watch. So all of those things research has shown are directly tied to the strength of local news in a community.
It feels almost to me like one of those what's the matter with Kansas moments where you say people are watching their news source disappearing, being reduced greatly. They're seeing the voice of their community slipping away. What options does the news consumer have insofar as helping to maintain the integrity of that agency?
Very simply put, individual news consumers, people who care about having a strong local news ecosystem, are going to have to stop taking it for granted. They're going to have to stop thinking that there's going to be a market-based solution to this problem. It's just simply not going to happen for all the reasons that Rick's film talks about. The market just simply isn't going to save it. So communities and individuals within those communities are going to have to start thinking about local independent journalism in the same way that they've long thought about the arts and education and healthcare and social services, in the way that communities rise up to support those things that the market does not support. So an individual can make a donation to a nonprofit newsroom. An individual can buy a subscription to their local newspaper if they still are lucky enough to have one. Local people, individuals who care about this, can make a big difference.
And Rick, going off of what Judith just said, the low-hanging fruit could be the web presence of a lot of these print agencies, but they're also in competition with a much broader spectrum than they have been 10, 20, 30 years ago. Are they still operating on an antiquated model, business model?
Well, I think they're not operating on the business model because the business model has gone away. And I don't want to be doom and gloom about this, because I think there's an opportunity here that is presenting itself. Traditionally, over the last 100, 200 years, newspapers have served a tremendous role in communities as both a public service and a commodity. So they've been driven by advertising, and they've had a business model where they're trying to satisfy the advertisers and the people who tend to read those newspapers and get those advertising, and maybe that's middle class, upper middle class. And a lot of communities, poorer communities, minority communities, communities that just haven't been served or are not served well. Sometimes minority communities appear in the newspapers traditionally, but often revolving around crime. And you don't get the sense of communities. We have reached a point now where the business model has gone away and the opportunity for the news organizations to be actual public service news organizations and serving communities better, serving poor communities better, serving workers better, affords us. So you have, on the one hand, you also have public radio stations like this that have been doing that and have been in the business of public service journalism without the advertising all along. And now you have other startups, nonprofit news organizations. Maybe they have a web presence of maybe 2, 3, or 10 reporters. Maybe they're not as robust as the newspapers, but they don't have the barrier that the old advertising model have to provide really public service journalism.
At the dawn of the internet, the narrative was, this is the great equalizer. This will bring parity and equity across news platforms for everybody everywhere. Judith, when you look across the news landscape of Central Florida, are you seeing the opportunities that Rick's describing for grassroots, startup, independent community media?
Absolutely. I think we are not ever going back to a time when there was one primary news source in most communities that was the big newspaper that can do it all. I don't think we're ever going back to that time because of the forces that we've been discussing. I think what we're moving to is an ecosystem-based model. I think we're going to a model where there might be a newspaper, but it's smaller than it was. There's a robust public media organization like Central Florida Public Media, and there are hyper-local digital news outlets like Oviedo Community News, like Winter Park Voice, like some of these great startups that have bubbled up here in our community that are covering pockets of the region in new and different ways. And I think that is really the way of the future. And I think to the extent that news consumers can become educated about the tapestry of options that they now have and can learn to tell the difference between a professional news organization and an influencer, for example, I think it's going to be a good thing. And I think, you know, when you look at the News Collaborative of Central Florida that we've launched here over the past year, that's an effort to knit all of those different actors together.
2050, are there still newspapers?
I would say the newspapers, if you're talking about a printed sheet with sections that you can turn to and, you know, the comics and Dear Abby and stuff like that, I would say no. I think we're going the way of the printed form going bye-bye. But most of the daily newspapers that are vibrant, and there still are many that are vibrant, and often they're the biggest newsroom in town still, they have a big web presence. And I don't think that's going to go away because most of them have adapted and are still adapting their way of delivering the news to this new channel, to this new format, which is not based on pieces of paper.
Yeah, I think what Rick's saying about adapting to the new reality is exactly right. I think when you look at what we've done here at Central Florida Public Media over the past several years, we're not just a radio station, and we changed our name to make sure everyone knew that. You know, we are bigger than our call letters. People can listen to us on the radio, but we have a robust news website. We have 4 local podcasts. We have a weekly newsletter. We have to meet people where they are. And we are active on social media. Our journalists now are doing video all the time. It's a radio station, but they're doing video, and they've embraced that because we realize we have to be in those spaces because that's where that younger generation is turning. I wouldn't be surprised if in 2050, newspapers as we see them now are a thing of the past, but journalism isn't going to be a thing of the past. I think one of the things that we're going to have to really think about as a news industry is, what does it mean to be a journalist? Who gets to call themselves a journalist?
What is journalism is a great question. And I think we can't ignore the elephant that's in the room at this point. We have a massive attack on journalism and journalists right now in the current administration. And the heart of watchdog journalism, and I stress the word watchdog, is to root out abuse of power and to hold people that might be doing something wrong on a public scale to account. And there are journalists out there that want to do that and are being actively preventive from doing that. And we have to be more vigilant even now with all the challenges. I did a film on hedge funds and journalism. I finished that film before January 20th, let's put it that way. And the challenges now are even more intense. And I think what that means is that journalists have to be more vigilant, more aggressive, fight through more barriers to really tell the truth and to root out abuses of power.
And that brings me to my circuit closing question. Alden and hedge funds like them found a successful model in going after newspapers like this. Where is there an opportunity to halt this vulture capitalism of media? Is there a legislative answer to this? Is there a regulatory answer to this?
That's a great question. I think in this political atmosphere, it's hard, but there has been legislation introduced, Stop Wall Street Looting Act, which is something that Senator Warren has proposed multiple times now. The fact of the matter is that there's almost no regulation to hedge funds, that they're put in a separate category. There's much more. Security and Exchange Commission has rules and regulations for your typical corporation and stock issuing company, that hedge funds don't have to meet those criteria. So there needs to be legislation. We have anti-monopoly, antitrust legislation that's on the books that could be used, that hasn't been used, that in the right political climate might be used to put limits on what hedge funds can be involved in. And I think the news industry is definitely one that shouldn't be subject to hedge fund ownership for a lot of reasons. But the fact of the matter is that hedge funds are in more and more of our public life, our public institutions, nursing homes, doctors, groups, you know, organization, prisons, trailer home parks, just about everything. And if we don't do something about that on a public scale with legislation, with regulation, then people are going to be more and more divorced from the institutions that make a difference in their lives.
Rick Goldsmith is the director of Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink. Judith Smelzer is the president and general manager of Central Florida Public Media. And you can view Stripped for Parts beginning next Wednesday, October 1st. The documentary will be streaming free and on demand through the end of the year at pbs.org. Coming up, Disney may have brought fantasy to Central Florida, but WWE brought the smackdown. Wrestler Jacob Fatu joins us to talk about life in and out of the ring. As always, our program is available on demand as a podcast on Spotify or Apple iTunes, or you can pick us up at our website, cfpublic.org. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. On next week's program, we'll look at the impact budgetary cuts are having on school libraries in Central Florida. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Have you seen a reduction in library services in your children's schools? We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at engage@cfpublic.org, or you can send us a talkback on the free Central Florida Public Media app. Right now, we're stepping into the ring ahead of WWE Friday Night SmackDown at the Kia Center tomorrow night. Central Florida has deep roots in the world of professional wrestling. The WWE Performance Center is in Orlando. It's their official training facility and development hub where many of the biggest stars launch their careers. You may not know it, but Engage host Sharon Stone and Are We There Yet host Brendan Byrne are both huge WWE fans. They tag-teamed this discussion with Central Florida resident and WWE superstar Jacob Fatu about the region's role in the ring.
Oh my God, Jacob Fatu, that's Samoan Drop Owens. This guy needs to be locked up.
This is the family member the sane ones want nothing to do with.
Oh my, he just put Arden in a barricade. This SOB ain't fit for public consumption.
How important is Orlando to WWE and wrestling?
My first tryout was at the WWE Performance Center, but not only that, a lot of us are actually out here. Orlando's more than important. Obviously, I moved me, my family, and out here. And shout out to Orlando, because, man, let me tell you something. It hasn't been nothing but a hell of a ride since I've been out here. And I'm talking about from the food to the weather, baby, to it not being cold on Christmas out here. So, yes, Orlando is very important to WWE. And also, Orlando is the best thing that has happened to me and my family since being signed with WWE.
Mm-hmm. Jacob, you are on the road most of the year, right, as the show travels the country, even across the globe. But you'll be returning here to what is now the town that you live in, the place where you got your start. What is it like to come back to Orlando and do a live show in front of this crowd?
I've been getting nothing but love since we've been out here, man. Friday night SmackDown, I'm very excited. Not only that, because every time I'm on the freeway, man, we pass the Kia Center. It means a lot for me because it's actually going to be my children's first time seeing their father perform at the Kia Center. So I'm very excited. Yeah.
How old are your kids?
Oh, man, girl, I got 7 kids. They range from 19 all the way to my youngest, 4. We got a whole nother bloodline going on around here.
Actually, since you brought up bloodlines, and when it comes to dynasties and just famous wrestling families, you are part of one of the most legendary. Our audience might know some of the names, The Rock, The Usos. How does that shape your mindset when you're in the ring or preparing?
First off, I would like to just say thank you to all my family who was actually there before me, who actually opened up the door, starting from The Rock's grandfather to The Rock's father, to my uncle Afa and Sika, and my father, the Tonka Kid, all the way to the Attitude Era with Rikishi. Now we're in this other era. We had a lot of family members to do this, but it made me step my game up. It made me want to figure out what my identity was for me coming in. I didn't want to just come in and just be the other cousin. I'm very grateful to really be a part of this family. There's a lot of great families in this business. But sorry if I get emotional just because, you know, this really has changed my life. Fatu is our real last name. So to hear the stadiums now, Champ Fatu, it gets really emotional sometimes. But I'm very, very thankful.
Mm-hmm. Jacob, as journalists, Sharon and I are storytellers. As a WWE superstar, you yourself are a storyteller every time you pick up a microphone or you go into the ring. And I think that gets lost on people who don't really know much about WWE. Can you tell me a bit about the stories that you tell in the ring and how you go about doing that? Is it planned? Do you kind of do it as you go? What stories are you trying to tell when you're in front of all those fans?
I've been doing it for 12 years, but then again, I haven't been at this level. I know when Jacob Fatu gets in there, You got to be turned all the way up as yourself. And I heard The Rock and Stone Cold said, you know, the great. So I'm taking a little bit of something from a little bit of everybody and trying to incorporate it into what Jacob Fatu was doing, a Samoan werewolf. But I just want people to feel it. I want people to really feel it. I don't want to just go in there and just do a backflip, do this and that. You know, this is another part of the game. Storytelling, man, is something that I'm very new to. I'm very happy to do it with nobody else besides my family.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about you as a performer. So, example, the second I hear the entrance music, I'm ready, I'm hype. And then Randy Orton comes down, gliding into greatness, entering the ring, and I'm just excited. I want to know from you, when is it you get pumped? Is it the second your music hits? Does your excitement build getting into the ring? How's it like for you?
I start working as soon as I walk out my front door. So I'm always working. But to actually get ready to walk out to that locker room or directly, oh yeah, it's just, I can't explain it. It's just walking down those hallways. Madison Square Garden always has that famous hallway where all the old school wrestlers walk down, coming down that hallway. I just always think about that. Coming out the locker room, seeing that right there, having our bosses right there, the greats is right there. Because, mind you, I've only been in WWE for a year, and I still get that same feeling. Sometimes I can't even believe that's me right there on top of the billboard right there, because I'm still a fan of all of this, you know? So, to answer your question, I'm sorry. I guess I'm just so excited, so I'm always answering other questions. But to answer it, it's just a whole nother feeling. It makes me feel unstoppable when I hear my music right before I walk out. It really does.
Jacob, you mentioned you've been a fan of this for years. You still are a fan. There has been a resurgence in interest in the WWE of late. I am one example, right? I grew up watching this. I stopped watching it for a while. And now in my mid-30s, I'm back to watching you every week. What do you think credits this kind of this new interest in WWE for adults like myself?
Man, people are coming back. People are in here that you would have never expected to be here. And WWE is making that happen. It's just a whole nother era. I feel it. And now when I go around, I just feel like it's just getting bigger now. Mm-hmm. You know, with all the platforms, everybody coming back. Man, it's just a whole nother shift and it's a whole nother era. They always say this in wrestling, timing is everything. And right now, I am so thankful to be a part of this time right now, what we got going on.
Can you speak to our audience who has never watched WWE a day in their life? Why do fans just connect so much with this?
Professional wrestling brings different cultures, different people, and different nationalities together. You know, obviously, we're all here doing this right now because of professional wrestling. But what they would expect, it's not just guys wrestling. Don't think it's just the men. No. I always say this all the time because how many kids I got. Women make the girl world go round. So if you guys really want to see a whole show put on, I mean, man, come see the greatest man. Come see the greatest women to ever do it. Especially if you're listening and you're following Orlando Radio. So September 26th, Friday, Kia Center. And it's going to be the best talent in the world. I'm excited for it. So, and not only that, now we can just drive to the building and drive right back home after.
I got to ask you, Jake, because whenever I watch you perform in the ring, it's incredible. And one of the things that you do is you perform a moonsault off the top rope. For people that don't know what that is, you get on that third rope and you essentially backflip on top of your opponent. You're a big dude, right? You're some 285 pounds. What's going through your head before you jump off that rope, which has got to be, what, 6-7 feet off the ground?
You know, we're not going to sugarcoat anything. The first thing is, please don't fall. Okay. The second thing is, you know, I know once I hit that, it's a wrap. Thank you for bringing that up, man. Mm-hmm. It's not difficult, but it's difficult, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Jacob, the show's coming to Orlando. You mentioned your kids are going to be there for the first time seeing you perform. What do you want other Orlando
perform? I'm not sure what we're doing, but, yeah. They're definitely going to be there.
They're going to be there. What do you want the audience to take away from this show?
What people think about professional wrestling? If you're listening now and you have somebody who you know, which is everybody, somebody that they know about WWE that is going to attend that show, I suggest you come get a ticket. Come sit down, enjoy it. Be in the crowd. Be locked in. See how everything's moving. just see how locked in the fans are and emotionally the wrestlers as well. And one of my favorite things is just having the crowd involved with the show. We're talking about Randy Orton. If you don't know who he is, once you come over there, buy a ticket and you hear that music hit, people are going to fall in love with it. They might not even fall in love with wrestling over the matches. They might fall in love with it because they see how involved they're letting all of the crowd be with us during the show. So just take it in and just enjoy it.
That's Central Florida Public Media's Sharon Stone and Brendan Byrne talking with WWE superstar Jacob Fatu. That's all for today's edition of Engage. I'm Richard Copeland sitting in for Sharon Stone. Thank you for joining us. All Things Considered is coming up following NPR News.